at the local inn without a writ of patronage. The university had been the center of my life for a solid year. Now, confronted with the necessity of leaving, I was utterly at sea, with no idea of what I could do with myself.
Chapter 50. Chasing the Wind. I gave my admissions tile to Fella, telling her I hoped it brought her luck. And so the winter term came to an end. Suddenly, 3/4 of my life simply disappeared. I had no classes to occupy my time, no shifts in the medica to fill. I could no longer check out materials from stocks, use tools in the fishery, or enter the archives. At first, it wasn't so bad. The midwinter pageantry was wonderfully distracting, and without the worry of work and study, I was free to enjoy myself and spend time in the company of my friends. Then spring term started. My friends were still there, but they were busy with their own studies. I found myself crossing the river more and more. Denna was still nowhere to be found, but Diok and Stanchion were always willing to share a drink and some idle gossip. Threp was there, too, and while he occasionally pressed me to attend a dinner at his house, I could tell his heart wasn't in it. My trial hadn't pleased people on this side of the river either, and they were still telling stories about it. I wouldn't be welcome in any respectable social circle for a great long time, if ever. I toyed with the idea of leaving the university. I knew people would forget about the trial more quickly if I wasn't around, but where would I go? The only thought that came to mind was heading off to Yill with the vain hope of finding Denna, but I knew that was nothing but foolishness. Since I didn't need to save money for tuition, I went to repay Davy. But for the first time ever, I wasn't able to find her. Over the course of several days, I grew increasingly nervous. I even slid several apologetic notes under her door until I heard from Mola that she was taking a holiday and would be returning soon. Days passed, and I sat idle as winter slowly withdrew from the university. Frost left the corners of window panes, drifts of snow dwindled, and trees began to show their first greening buds. Eventually, Simon caught his first glimpse of bare leg beneath a flowing dress and declared spring had officially arrived. One afternoon, as I sat drinking metheglin with Stanchion, Threp came through the door practically bubbling with excitement. He whisked me off to a private table on the second tier, looking ready to burst with whatever news he was carrying. Threp folded his hands on the tabletop.
"Since we haven't had much luck finding you a local patron, I started casting my nets farther afield. It's nice to have a local patron, but if you have the support of a properly influential lord, it hardly matters where he lives."
I nodded. My troop had ranged all over the four corners under the protection of Lord Greyfellow's name. Threp grinned.
"Have you ever been to Vintus?"
"Possibly," I said. Then, seeing his puzzled look, I explained. "I traveled quite a bit when I was young. I can't remember if we ever made it that far east." He nodded.
"Do you know who the Mayor Alvaran is?"
I did, but I could tell Threp was bursting to tell me himself. "I seem to remember something," I said vaguely. Threp grinned.
"You know the expression, rich as the King of Vint?"
I nodded.
"Well, that's him. His great-great-grandfathers were the kings of Vint, back before the Empire stomped in, converting everyone to the Iron Law and the Book of the Path. If not for a few quirks of fate a dozen generations back, Alvaran would be the royal family of Vintus, not the Calanthus. And my friend, the mayor, would be the king."
"Your friend?" I said appreciatively. "You know Mayor Alvaran?" Threp made a vacillating gesture.
"Friend may be stretching things a little," he admitted. "We've been corresponding for some years, exchanging news from our different corners of the world, doing each other a favor or two. It would be more appropriate to say we're acquainted."
"An impressive acquaintance. What is he like?"
"His letters are quite polite. Never a bit snobby, even though he does stand quite a good rank above me,"
Threp said modestly.
"He's every bit a king except for the title and crown, you know. When Vintus formed, his family refused to surrender any of their plenary powers. That means the mayor has the authority to do most anything King Roderick himself can do. Grant titles, raise an army, coin money, levy taxes.
Threp shook his head sharply.
Ah, I forget what I'm doing, he said as he began to search his pockets. I received a letter from him only yesterday.
He produced a piece of paper, unfolded it, then cleared his throat and read,
I know you are knee-deep in poets and musicians out there, and I am rather in need of a young man who is good with words. I cannot find anyone to suit me here in Severin, and, everything said, I would prefer the best. He should be good with words above all, perhaps a musician of some sort. After that, I would desire him to be clever, well-spoken, mannerly, educated, and discreet. On reading this list, you may see why I have had no luck finding such a one for myself. If you happen to know a man of this rare sort, encourage him to call on me. I would tell you what use I intend to put him to, but the matter is of a private nature.
Threp studied the letter for a moment or two.
It goes on for a bit. Then he says, As to the matter I mentioned before, I am in some haste. If there is no one suitable in Imre, please send me a letter by post. If you happen to send someone my way, encourage him to make speed.
Threp's eyes scanned the paper for a moment more, his lips moving silently.
That's all of it, he said finally, and tucked it back into a pocket. What do you think?
You do me a great...
Yes, yes, he waved a hand impatiently. You're flattered. Skip all that.
He leaned forward seriously.
Will you do it? Will your studies...
He made a dismissive gesture westward toward the university.
Permit an absence of a season or so?
I cleared my throat. I've actually been considering taking my studies abroad for a time.
The Count burst into a wide grin and thumped the arm of his chair.
Good! He laughed. I thought I was going to have to pry you out of your precious university like a penny from a dead shim's fist. This is a wonderful opportunity, you realize. Once in a lifetime, really.
He gave me a sly wink.
Besides, a young man like yourself would be hard-pressed to find a better patron than a man who's richer than the King of Vint.
There's some truth to that, I admitted aloud. Silently, I thought, could I hope for better assistance in my search for the Emir?
There's much truth to that, he chuckled. How soon can you be ready to leave?
I shrugged. Tomorrow? Threp raised an eyebrow.
You don't give much time for the dust to settle, do you?
He said he was in haste, and I'd rather be early than late.
True, true.
He drew a silver gear watch from his pocket, looked at it, then sighed as he clicked it closed.
I'll have to miss some sleep tonight drafting a letter of introduction for you.
I glanced at the window. It's not even dark yet, I said. How long do you expect it to take?
Hush! He said crossly. I write slowly, especially when I'm sending a letter to someone as important as the mayor. Plus, I have to describe you. No easy task by itself.
Let me help you then, I said. No sense losing sleep on my account. I smiled. Besides, if there's one thing I'm well versed in, it's my own good qualities. The next day, I made a round of hasty goodbyes to everyone I knew at the university. I received heartfelt handshakes from Willem and Simon, and a cheerful wave from Ari. Kilvin grunted without looking up from his engraving and told me to write down any ideas I might have for the ever-burning lamp while I was away. Arwill gave me a long, penetrating look through his spectacles and told me there would be a place for me in the Medica when I returned. Elxadal was refreshing after the other master's reserved responses. He laughed and admitted he was a little jealous of my freedom. He advised me to take full advantage of every reckless opportunity that presented itself. If 1,000 miles wasn't enough to keep my escapade secret, he said, then nothing would. I had no luck finding Elodin, and settled for sliding a note under the door of his office. Though since he never seemed to use the place, it might be months before he found it. I bought a new travel sack and a few other things a sympathist should never be without. Wax, string and wire, hook, needle and gut. My clothes were easy to pack, as I didn't own many. As I loaded my pack, I slowly realized I couldn't take everything with me. This came as something of a shock. For so many years, I'd been able to carry everything I've owned, usually with a hand to spare. But since I'd moved into this small garret room, I'd begun gathering oddments and half-finished projects. I now had the luxury of two blankets. There were pages of notes, a circular piece of half-inscribed tin from the fishery, a broken gear clock I'd taken to pieces to see if I could put it back together again. I finished loading my travel sack, then packed everything else into the trunk that sat at the foot of my bed. A few worn tools, a broken piece of slate I used for ciphering, a small wooden box with the handful of small treasures Ari had given me. Then I went downstairs and asked Anchor if he would mind stowing my possessions in the basement until I returned. He admitted a little guiltily that before I'd started sleeping there, the tiny slant-ceilinged room had been empty for years and only used for storage. He was willing to leave it unrented if I promised to continue our current room for music arrangement after I returned. I gladly agreed, and swinging my loot case onto my shoulder, I headed out the door. I wasn't entirely surprised to find Elodin on Stonebridge. Very little about the Master Namer surprised me these days. He sat on the waist-high stone lip of the bridge, swinging his bare feet over the 100-foot drop to the river below. "Hello, Cloth," he said without turning his eyes from the churning water. "Hello, Master Elodin," I said. "I'm afraid I'm going to be leaving the university for a term or two." "Are you really afraid?" I noticed a whisper of amusement in his quiet, resonant voice. It took me a moment to realize what he was referring to. "It's just a figure of speech." "The figures of our speaking are like pictures of names. Vague, weak names, but names nonetheless. Be mindful of them." He looked up at me. "Sit with me for a moment." I started to excuse myself, then hesitated. He was my sponsor, after all. I set down my loot and travel sack on the flat stone of the bridge. A fond smile came over Elodin's boyish face, and he slapped the stone parapet next to himself with the flat of his hand, offering me a seat. I looked over the edge with a hint of anxiety. "I'd rather not, Master Elodin." He gave me a reproachful look. "Caution suits an Arcanist. Assurance suits a Namer. Fear does not suit either. It does not suit you." He slapped the stone again, more firmly this time. I carefully climbed onto the parapet and swung my feet over the edge. The view was spectacular, exhilarating. "Can you see the wind?" I tried. For a moment, it seemed as if... No, it was nothing. I shook my head. Elodin shrugged nonchalantly, though I sensed a hint of disappointment. "This is a good place for a Namer. Tell me why." I looked around. "Wide wind, strong water, old stone." "Good answer." I heard genuine pleasure in his voice. "But there is another reason. Stone, water, and wind are other places, too. What makes this different?" I thought for a moment, looked around, shook my head. "I don't know." "Another good answer. Remember it." I waited for him to continue. When he didn't, I asked, "What makes this a good place?" He looked out over the water for a long time before he answered. "It is an edge," he said at last. "It is a high place with a chance of falling. Things are more easily seen from edges. Danger rouses the sleeping mind. It makes some things clear. Seeing things is a part of being a Namer." "What about falling?" I asked. "If you fall, you fall," Elodin shrugged. "Sometimes falling teaches us things, too. In dreams, you often fall before you wake." We were both silent in our thoughts for a while. I closed my eyes and tried to listen for the name of the wind. I heard the water below, felt the stone of the bridge beneath my palms. Nothing. "Do you know what they used to say when a student left the university for a term?" Elodin asked. I shook my head. "They said he was chasing the wind," he chuckled. "I've heard the expression." "Have you? What did it seem to mean?" I took a moment to choose my words. It had a frivolous flavor, as if students were running around to no good purpose.
Elodin nodded. Most students leave for frivolous reasons, or to pursue frivolous things.
He leaned forward to look straight down at the river below.
But that was not always the meaning of it.
No?
No.
He sat back up again.
Long ago, when all students aspired to be namers, things were different.
He licked a finger and held it to the air.
The name most fledgling namers were encouraged to find was that of the wind. After they found that name, their sleeping minds were aroused, and finding other names was easier. But some students had trouble finding the name of the wind. There were too few edges here, too little risk. So they would go off into the wild, uneducated lands. They would seek their fortunes, have adventures, hunt for secrets and treasure.
He looked at me. But they were really looking for the name of the wind. Our conversation paused as someone came onto the bridge. It was a man with dark hair and a pinched face. He was watching us from the corner of his eye without turning his head, and as he walked behind us, I tried not to think how easy it would be for him to push me off the bridge. Then he was past us. Elodin gave a weary sigh and continued.
Things have changed. There are even fewer edges now than there were before. The world is less wild. There are fewer magics, more secrets, and only a handful of people who know the name of the wind.
You know it, don't you? I asked.
Elodin nodded. It changes from place to place, but I know how to listen for its changing shape.
He laughed and clapped me on the shoulder.
You should go! Chase the wind! Do not be afraid of the occasional risk.
He smiled.
In moderation.
I swung my legs around, hopped off the thick wall, and resettled my loot and travel sack over my shoulder. But as I started toward Imre, Elodin's voice stopped me.
Kvothe!
I turned and saw Elodin lean forward over the side of the bridge. He grinned like a schoolboy.
Spit for luck!
Davy opened the door for me and widened her eyes in shock.
My goodness!
She said, pressing a piece of paper dramatically to her chest. I recognized it as one of the notes I left under her door.
It's my secret admirer.
I was trying to pay off my loan, I said. I made 4 trips.
The walk is good for you,
she said with a cheerful lack of sympathy as she motioned me inside, bolting the door behind me. The room smelled of... I sniffed.
What is that? I asked.
Her expression went rueful. It was supposed to be pear. I lay down my loot case and travel sack and took a seat at her desk. Despite my best intentions, my eyes were drawn to the charred black ring. Davy tossed her strawberry blonde hair and met my eye.
Care for a rematch? She asked, her mouth curving.
I can still take you, Graham or no Graham. I can take you while I'm dead asleep.
I'll admit to being curious, I said. But I should tend to business instead.
Very well, she said. Are you really going to pay me off entire? Have you finally found yourself a patron? I shook my head. However, I have had a remarkable opportunity arise. The chance to get a fine patron indeed. I paused.
Inventus.
She raised an eyebrow.
That's a long ways off, she said pointedly.
I'm glad you stopped to settle your debt before jaunting off to the other side of the world. Who knows when you'll be back?
Indeed, I said. However, I find myself in a bit of an odd place, financially speaking.
Davy was already shaking her head before I finished speaking.
Absolutely not. You're already into me for 9 talents. I'm not loaning you more money the day you leave town.
I held up my hands defensively. You misunderstand. I said. I opened my purse and spilled talents and jots onto the table. Denna's ring tumbled out, too, and I stopped it before it could roll off the edge of the table. I gestured to the pile of coins in front of me, slightly more than 13 talents. This is all the money I have in the world, I said. With it, I need to get myself to Severin with fair speed. 1,000 miles with some to spare,
That means passage on at least one ship, food, lodging, money for coaches, or the use of a post note. As I listed each of these things, I slid an appropriate amount of money from one side of the desk to the other. When I finally arrive in Severin, I will need to buy myself clothes that will allow me to move among the court without looking like the ragged musician I am. I slid more coins. I pointed at the few straggling coins remaining. This does not leave me enough to settle my debt with you. Davy watched me over her steepled fingers. I see, she said seriously. We must discover some alternate method for you to square your debt.
My thought is this, I said. I can leave you with collateral against my eventual return. Her eyes flickered down to the slender, dark shape of my loot case.
Not my loot, I said quickly. I need that.
What then? She asked.
You've always said you have no collateral.
I have a few things, I said, rummaging around in my travel sack, and brought up a book.
Davy's eyes lit up. Then she read the spine.
Rhetoric and logic?
She made a face.
I feel the same way, I said, but it's worth something, especially to me.
Also, I reached into the pocket of my cloak and brought out my hand lamp.
I have this, a sympathy lamp of my own design. It has a focused beam and a grated switch.
Davy picked it up off the desk, nodding to herself.
I remember this, she said. Before, you said you couldn't give it up because of a promise you'd made to Kilvin. Has that changed?
I gave a bright smile that was two-thirds lie.
That promise is actually what makes that lamp the perfect piece of collateral, I said. If you take this lamp to Kilvin, I have every confidence he will pay a lavish sum just to get it out of...
I cleared my throat.
Unsavory hands.
Davy flicked the switch idly with her thumb, spinning it from dim to bright and back again.
And I imagine this would be a stipulation you require, that I return it to Kilvin.
You know me so well, I said. It's almost embarrassing.
Davy set the lamp back on the table next to my book and took a slow breath through her nose.
A book that's only valuable to you, she said, and a lamp that's only valuable to Kilvin.
She shook her head.
This is not an appealing offer.
I felt a pang as I reached to my shoulder and unclasped my talent pipes and slid them onto the table as well.
Those are silver, I said, and hard to come by. They'll get you into the Aeolian free, too.
I know what they are.
Davy picked them up and looked them over with a sharp eye.
Then she pointed. You had a ring.
I froze.
That's not mine to give.
Davy laughed.
It's in your pocket, isn't it?
She snapped her fingers. Come now.
Let me see it.
I brought it out of my pocket, but I didn't hand it over. I went through a lot of trouble for this, I said. It's the ring Ambrose took from a friend of mine. I'm just waiting to return it to her.
Davy sat silently, her hand outstretched. After a moment, I put the ring onto her palm.
She held it close to the lamp and leaned forward, squinting, one eye closed on her pixie face.
That's a nice stone, she said appreciatively.
The setting's new, I said miserably. Davy set the ring carefully on top of the book next to my pipes and hand lamp.
Here is the deal, she said. I will keep these items as collateral against your current debt of 9 talents. This will last for the space of 1 year.
A year and a day, I said.
A smile curved the corner of her mouth.
How storybook of you.
Very well.
This will postpone your repayment for 1 year and 1 day. If you have not repaid me by the end of that time, these items will be forfeit, and our debt will be cleared.
Her smile went sharp.
Though I may be persuaded to return them in exchange for certain information.
I heard the belling tower in the distance and gave a deep sigh. I didn't have much time for bargaining as I was already late for my meeting with Threp.
Fine, I said, irritated. But the ring will be kept somewhere safe. You can't wear it until I've defaulted.
Davy frowned.
You don't... I'm not movable on this point, I said seriously. It belongs to a friend. It is precious to her, and I would not have her see it on someone else's hand. Not after everything I did to get it back from Ambrose. Davy said nothing, her pixie face set in a grim expression. I put on my own grim expression and met her eye. I do a good grim expression when I need to. A long moment of silence stretched between us. Fine, she said at last. We shook hands. A year and a day, I said. Chapter 51 All Wise Men Fear. I stopped by the Aeolian, where Threp was waiting for me, practically dancing with impatience. He had, he told me, found a boat heading downriver in less than an hour. What's more, he had already paid my way as far as Tarbian, where I should easily be able to find passage east. The two of us hurried to the docks, arriving just as the ship was going through its final preparations. Threp, red-faced and puffing from our brisk walk, hurried to give me a lifetime's worth of advice in the space of 3 minutes.
"The mayor is old, old blood," he said. "Not like most of the little nobility around these parts who can't tell you who their great-grandfathers are. So treat him with respect."
I rolled my eyes. Why did everyone always expect me to behave so poorly?
"And remember," he said, "if you look like you're chasing money, they'll see you as provincial. As soon as that happens, no one will take you seriously. You're there to curry favor. That's the high-stakes game. Besides, fortune follows favor, as they say. If you get one, you'll have the other. It's like what Teckham wrote. The cost of a loaf is a simple thing, and so a loaf is often sought.
But some things are past valuing. Laughter, land, and love are never bought," I finished. It was actually a quote from Gregan the Lesser, but I didn't bother correcting him.
"Ho there!"
a tan bearded man shouted to us from the deck of the ship.
"We got one straggler we're waiting on, and Captain's angry as an ugly whore. He swears he'll leave if he ain't here in 2 minutes. You'd do well to be aboard by then."
He wandered off without waiting for a reply.
"Address him as Your Grace,"
Threp continued, as if we hadn't been interrupted.
"And remember, speak least if you would be most often heard. Oh!"
He drew a sealed letter from his breast pocket.
"Here's your letter of introduction. I may send another copy by post, just so he knows to expect you."
I gave him a broad smile and gripped his arm. "Thank you, Den," I said earnestly, "for everything. I appreciate all of this more than you know." Threp waved the comment aside.
"I know you'll do splendidly. You're a clever boy. Mind that you find a good tailor when you get there. The fashions will be different. As they say, know a lady by her manner, a man by his cloth."
I knelt and opened up my loot case. Moving the loot aside, I pressed the lid of the secret compartment and twisted it open. I slid Threp's sealed letter inside, where it joined the hollow horn with Nina's drawing in a small sack of dried apple I had stowed there. There was nothing special about the dried apple, but in my opinion, if you have a secret compartment in your loot case and don't use it to hide things, there is something terribly, terribly wrong with you. I snapped the clasps closed, refastening the lid, then stood and gathered up my belongings, ready to board the ship. Threp gripped my shoulder suddenly.
"I almost forgot. Elveron mentioned in one of his letters that the young people in his court gamble. He thinks it's a deplorable habit, so stay clear of it. And remember, small thaws make great floods, so be twice wary of a slowly changing season."
I saw someone running down the dock toward us. It was the pinch-faced man who had passed Elodin and me on Stonebridge earlier. He carried a cloth-wrapped package close under one arm. "I'm guessing that's their missing sailor," I said quickly. "I'd better get aboard." I gave Threp a quick embrace and tried to get away before he could give me any more advice. But he caught my sleeve as I turned.
"Be careful on your way there," he said, his expression anxious. "Remember, there are three things all wise men fear. The sea in storm, a night with no moon, and the anger of a gentle man."
The sailor passed us and hit the gangplank running, unmindful of how the board jounced and clattered under his feet. I gave Threp a reassuring smile and followed close on his heels. Two leathery men hauled up the plank, and I returned Threp's final wave. Orders were shouted, men scrambled, and the ship began to move. I turned to face downriver, toward Tarbian, toward the sea. Chapter 52. A Brief Journey. My route was a simple one. I would head downriver to Tarbian, through the Refting Strait, down the coast toward Junpui, then up the Arend River. It was more roundabout than going over land, but better in the long run. Even if I were to purchase a post letter and change horses at every opportunity, it would still take me almost 3 span to reach Severin over land. And most of that time would be in southern Aetur and the small kingdoms. Only priests and fools expected the roads in that part of the world to be safe. The water route added several 100 miles to the distance traveled, but ships at sea need not mind the twistings and turnings of a road. And while a good horse can set a better pace than a ship, you can't ride a horse day and night without stopping to rest. The water route would take about 12 days, depending on the weather. My curiosity was also glad to take the sea route. I had never been on any water larger than a river. My only real concern was that I might become bored with nothing but wind, waves, and sailors for company. Several unfortunate complications arose during the trip. In brief, there was a storm, piracy, treachery, and shipwreck, although not in that order. It also goes without saying that I did a great many things, some heroic, some ill-advised, some clever and audacious. Over the course of my trip, I was robbed, drowned, and left penniless on the streets of Junpui. In order to survive, I begged for crusts, stole a man's shoes, and recited poetry. The last should demonstrate more than all the rest how truly desperate my situation became. However, as these events have little to do with the heart of the story, I must pass them over in favor of more important things. Simply said, it took me 16 days to reach Severin. A bit longer than I had planned, but at no point during my journey was I ever bored. Chapter 53. The Shear. I limped through the gates of Severin, ragged, penniless, and hungry. I am no stranger to hunger. I know the countless hollow shapes it takes inside you. This particular hunger wasn't a terrible one. I'd eaten 2 apples and some salt pork a day ago, so this hunger was merely painful. It wasn't the bad hunger that leaves you weak and trembling. I was safe from that for at least 8 hours or so. Over the last 2 span, everything I owned had been lost, destroyed, stolen, or abandoned. The only exception was my loot. Denna's marvelous case had paid for itself 10 times during my trip. In addition to saving my life on one occasion, it had protected my loot, Threp's letter of introduction, and Nina's invaluable drawing of the Chandrian. You may notice I don't include any clothing on my list of possessions. There are 2 good reasons for this. The first is that you couldn't really call the grubby rags I wore clothing without stretching the truth to its breaking point. Secondly, I had stolen them, so it doesn't seem right to claim them as my own. The most irritating was the loss of Fella's cloak. I'd been forced to tear it up and use it for bandages in Junpui. Nearly as bad was the fact that my hard-won gram now lay somewhere deep below the cold, dark waters of the Sentha Sea. The city of Severin was split into 2 unequal portions by a tall, white cliff. The majority of the living business of the city took place in the larger portion of the city at the foot of this cliff, aptly named the Shear. Atop the Shear was a much smaller piece of the city. It consisted mostly of estates and manor houses belonging to aristocracy and wealthy merchants. Also present were the attendant number of tailors, liveries, theaters, and brothels necessary to provide for the needs of the upper class. The stark cliff of white stone looked as if it had been thrust skyward to give the nobility a better view of the countryside. As it wandered off to the northeast and south, it lost height and stature. But where it bisected Severin, it was 200 feet tall and steep as a garden wall. In the center of the city, a wide peninsula of cliff jutted out from the Shear. Perched on this outthrust piece of cliff was Mayor Alvaron's estate.
Its pale stone walls were visible from anywhere in the city below. The effect was daunting, as if the mayor's ancestral home was peering down on you. Seeing it without a coin in my pocket or a decent set of clothes on my back was rather intimidating. I'd planned to take Threp's letter straight to the mayor despite my disheveled state, but looking up at the tall stone walls, I realized I probably wouldn't be let through the front door. I looked like a filthy beggar. I had few resources and even fewer options to choose from. With the exception of Ambrose some miles to the south in his father's barony, I didn't know a single soul in all of Ventus. I've begged before, and I've stolen, but only when I've had no other options available to me. They are dangerous occupations, and only a complete fool attempts them in an unfamiliar city, let alone an entirely new country. Here in Ventus, I didn't even know what laws I might be breaking. So I gritted my teeth and took the only option available to me. I wandered barefoot through the cobblestone streets of Severin Low until I found a pawn shop in one of the better parts of the city. I stood across the street for the better part of an hour, watching the people come and go, trying to think of some better option, but I simply didn't have one. So I removed Threp's letter and Nina's painting from the secret compartment in my loot case, crossed the street, and pawned my loot and case for 8 silver nobles and a span note. If you've led the sort of easy life that's never taken you to the pawners, let me explain. The note was a receipt of sorts, and with it, I could buy my loot back for the same amount of money, so long as I did it within 11 days. On the 12th day, it became the property of the pawnbroker, who would undoubtedly turn around and sell it for 10 times that amount. Back on the street, I hefted the coins. They seemed thin and insubstantial compared to Sealdish currency, or the heavy Commonwealth pennies I was familiar with. Still, money spends the same the world round, and 7 nobles bought me a fine suit of clothes of the sort a gentleman might wear, along with a pair of soft leather boots. What remained bought a haircut, shave, bath, and my first solid meal in 3 days. After that, I was coin poor again, but feeling much more sure of myself. Still, I knew it would be difficult to make my way to the mayor. Men with his degree of power live within layers of protection. There are customary graceful ways to navigate these layers. Introductions and audiences, messages and rings, calling cards and ass-kissing. But with only 11 days to get my loot out of pawn, my time was too precious for that. I needed to make contact with Alvaron quickly. So I made my way to the foot of the Shire and found a small cafe that catered to a genteel clientele. I used one of my precious few remaining coins to buy a mug of chocolate and a seat with a view of the haberdashers across the street. Over the next several hours, I listened to the gossip that flowed through such places. Even better, I won the trust of the clever young boy who worked at the cafe, waiting to refill my mug if I so desired. With his help and some casual eavesdropping, I learned a great deal about the mayor's court in a short amount of time. Eventually, the shadows grew longer, and I decided it was time to move. I called the boy over and pointed across the street. "Do you see that gentleman? The one in the red vest?"
"Yes, sir."
"Do you know who it is?"
"The Esquire Bergen, if it please you."
I needed someone more important than that. "How about the cross-looking fellow in the awful yellow hat?" The boy hid a smile.
"That's Baronet Pitour."
"Perfect." I stood and clapped Jim on the back. "You'll do well for yourself with a memory like that. Keep well." I gave him halfpenny and strolled to where the baronet stood, fingering a bolt of deep green velvet. It goes without saying that in terms of social rank, there are none lower than the Edima Rue. Even leaving aside my heritage, I was a landless commoner. This meant, in terms of social standing, the baronet was so high above me that if he were a star, I would not be able to see him with the naked eye. A person of my position should address him as my lord, avoid eye contact, and bow deeply and humbly. Truth be told, a person of my social standing shouldn't speak to him at all. Things were different in the Commonwealth, of course, and the university itself was particularly egalitarian. But even there, nobility were still rich and powerful and well-connected. People like Ambrose would always run roughshod over folk like myself. And if things got difficult, he could always hush things up or bribe a judge to get himself out of trouble. But I was in Vintus now. Here, Ambrose wouldn't need to bribe the judge. If I'd accidentally jostled the Baronet Pateur in the street while I was still barefoot and muddy, he could have horsewhipped me bloody, then called the constable to arrest me for being a public nuisance. The constable would have done it, too, with a smile and a nod. Let me try to say this more succinctly. In the Commonwealth, the gentry are people with power and money. In Vintus, the gentry have power and money and privilege. Many rules simply do not apply to them. That meant in Vintus, social rank was of utmost importance. That meant if the baronet knew I was below him, he would lord it over me, quite literally. On the other hand, as I walked across the street toward the baronet, I straightened my shoulders and raised my chin a bit. I stiffened my neck and narrowed my eyes slightly. I looked around as if I owned the entire street, and it was currently something of a disappointment. "Baronet Pateur," I said briskly. The man looked up, smiled vaguely as if he couldn't decide if he recognized me or not.
"Yes."
I made a curt gesture toward the shear.
"You would be doing the mayor a great service if you would escort me to his estate as quickly as possible."
I kept my expression stern, almost angry.
"Well, certainly."
He sounded anything but certain. I could sense the questions, the excuses beginning to bubble up in him. I fixed the baronet with my haughtiest stare. The edema might be on the lowest rung of the social ladder, but there are no finer actors breathing. I had been raised on the stage, and my father could play a king so regal I'd seen audiences doff their hats when he made his entrance. I made my eyes as hard as agates and looked the florid man up and down as if he were a horse I wasn't sure I cared to bet on. "If the matter were not urgent, I would never impose on you this way." I hesitated, then added a stiff, reluctant, "Sir." Baronet Pateur looked me in the eye. He was slightly off balance, but not nearly as much as I'd hoped. Like most nobility, he was self-centered as a gyroscope, and the only thing keeping him from sniffing and looking down his nose at me was his uncertainty. He eyed me, trying to decide if he could risk offending me by asking my name and how we were acquainted. But I still had a final trick to play. I brought out the thin, sharp smile the porter at the Gray Man had used when I had come calling on Denna all those months ago. As I'd said, it was a good smile. Gracious, polite, and more patronizing than if I'd reached out and patted the man on the head like a dog. The Baronet Pateur bore up under the weight of the smile for almost a full second. Then he cracked like an egg, his shoulders rounding a bit, and his manner becoming ever so slightly obsequious.
"Any service I can lend the mayor is a service I'm glad to render," he said. "Please, allow me."
He took the lead, heading toward the foot of the cliff. Following behind, I smiled. Chapter 54, The Messenger. I managed to bluff and fast-talk my way through the majority of the mayor's defenses. The Baronet Pateur helped me simply by his presence. Being escorted by a recognizable member of the nobility was enough to get me deep inside Alvaron's estate. After that, he soon outlived his usefulness, and I left him behind. Once he was out of sight, I put on my most impatient face, asked a busy servant for directions, and made it all the way to the outer doors of the mayor's audience chamber before I was stopped by an unassuming man in his middle years. He was portly, with a round face, and despite his fine clothes, he looked like a grocer to me. If not for the several hours I'd spent gathering information in Severin Low, I might have made a terrible mistake and tried to bluff my way past this man, thinking him nothing more than a well-dressed servant. But this was actually the person I was looking for, the mayor's manservant, Stapes. Though he looked like a grocer, He had the aura of true authority about him. His manner was quiet and certain, unlike the overbearing, brash one I had used to bully the baronet.
"How can I help you?"
Stapes asked. His tone was perfectly polite, but there were other questions lurking beneath the surface of his words. "Who are you? What are you doing here?" I brought out Count Threp's letter and handed it over with a slight bow. "You would be doing me a great service if you would convey this to the mayor," I said. "He is expecting me." Stapes gave me a cool look, making it perfectly clear that if the mayor had been expecting me, he would have known about it 10 days ago. He rubbed his chin as he looked me over, and I saw he wore a dull iron ring with gold letters scrolling across the surface. Despite his obvious misgivings, Stapes took the letter and disappeared through a set of double doors. I stood in the hallway for a nervous minute before he returned and ushered me inside, his manner still vaguely disapproving. We moved through a short hallway, then came to a second set of doors flanked by armored guards. These weren't ceremonial guards of the sort you sometimes see in public, standing stiffly at attention, holding halberds. They wore the mayor's colors, but beneath their sapphire and ivory were functional breastplates with steel rings and leather. Each man wore a long sword and a long knife. They eyed me seriously as I approached. The mayor's manservant nodded to me, and one of the guards manhandled me in a quick, competent way, sliding his hands along my arms and legs and around my chest, searching for hidden weapons. I was suddenly very glad for some of the misfortunes on my trip, specifically the ones that had ended with me losing the pair of slender knives I'd grown accustomed to wearing underneath my clothes. The guard stepped back and nodded. Then Stapes gave me another irritated look and opened the inner door. Inside, two men sat at a map-strewn table. One was tall and bald with the hard, weathered look of a veteran soldier. Next to him sat the mayor. Alvaron was older than I had expected. He had a serious face, proud around the mouth and eyes. His well-trimmed salt-and-pepper beard had very little black left to it, but his hair was still full and thick. His eyes, too, seemed to belie his age. They were clear gray, clever, and piercing. They were not the eyes of an old man. The mayor turned those eyes on me as I entered the room. He held Threp's letter in one hand. I made a standard number 3 bow, the messenger, as my father called it, low and formal, as fitting the mayor's high station. Deferential, but not obsequious. Just because I tread heavily on propriety's toes doesn't mean I can't play the game when it's of use to me. The mayor's eyes flickered down to the letter, then back up.
"Quoth, is it? You travel swiftly to arrive in such good time. I'd not expected even a reply from the Count so soon."
"I made all possible speed to put myself at your disposal, Your Grace."
"Indeed."
He looked me over carefully.
"And you seem to vindicate the Count's opinion of your wit by making it all the way to my door with nothing but a sealed letter in your hand."
"I thought it best to present myself as soon as possible, Your Grace," I said neutrally. "Your letter implied you were in some haste."
"And an impressive job you did of it, too,"
Alvaron said, glancing at the tall man sitting at the table next to him.
"Wouldn't you say, Dagon?"
"Yes, Your Grace."
Dagon looked at me with dark, dispassionate eyes. His face was hard and sharp and emotionless. I suppressed a shiver. Alvaron glanced down at the letter again.
"Threp certainly has some flattering things to say about you here," he said. "Well-spoken, charming, most talented musician he's met in 10 years.
The mayor continued reading, then looked back up, his eyes shrewd.
"You seem a bit young," he said hesitantly. "You're barely past 20, aren't you?"
I was a month past my 16th birthday, a fact I'd pointedly omitted from the letter.
"I am young, Your Grace," I admitted, sidestepping the actual lie. "But I've been making music since I was 4.
I spoke with quiet confidence, doubly glad of my new clothes. In my rags,
I couldn't have helped but look like a starving urchin. As it was, I was well-dressed and tanned from my days at sea, and the lean lines of my face added years to my appearance. Elveron eyed me for a long, speculative moment, then nodded, apparently satisfied. "Very well," he said. "Unfortunately, I am rather busy at present. Would tomorrow be convenient for you?" It wasn't really a question. "Have you found lodgings in the city?" "I have not made any arrangements as of yet, Your Grace." "You will stay here," he said evenly. "Stapes?" He called in a voice hardly louder than his normal speaking tone, and the portly, grocer-looking fellow appeared almost instantly. "Set our new guest somewhere in the south wing, near the gardens." He turned back to me. "Will your luggage be following?" "I fear all my luggage was lost on the way, Your Grace. Shipwreck." Elveron raised an eyebrow briefly. "Stapes will see you are properly outfitted." He folded Threp's letter and made a gesture of dismissal. "Good evening." I made a quick bow and followed Stapes from the room. The rooms were the most opulent I'd ever seen, let alone lived in, full of old wood and polished stone. The bed had a feather mattress a foot thick, and when I drew its curtains and lay inside, it seemed as big as my entire room back at Anchor's. My rooms were so pleasant it took me almost a full day to realize how much I hated them. Again, you have to think in terms of shoes. You don't want the biggest pair. You want a pair that fits. If your shoes are too big, your feet chafe and blister. In a similar way, my rooms chafed at me. There was an immense empty wardrobe, empty chests of drawers, and bare bookshelves. My room and Anchor's had been tiny, but here, I felt like a dried pea rattling around inside an empty jewelry box. But while the rooms were too large for my non-existent possessions, they were too small for me. I was obliged to remain there, waiting for the mayor to summon me. Since I had no idea when this might happen, I was effectively trapped. In defense of the mayor's hospitality, I should mention a few positive things. The food was excellent, if somewhat cold by the time it made its way from the kitchens. There was also a wonderful copper bathing basin. Servants brought the hot water, but it drained away through a series of pipes. I had not expected to find such conveniences so far from the civilizing influence of the university. I was visited by one of the mayor's tailors, an excitable little man who measured me 6 dozen different ways while chattering about the court gossip. The next day, a runner boy delivered 2 elaborate suits of clothing in colors that flattered me. In a way, I was fortunate I'd met with trouble at sea. The clothing Alvaron's tailors supplied was much better than anything I could have afforded, even with Threp's help. As a result, I cut quite a striking figure during my stay in Severin. Best of all, while checking the fit of my clothes, the chatty tailor mentioned cloaks were in fashion. I took the opportunity to exaggerate somewhat about the cloak Fella had given me, bemoaning the loss of it. The result was a richly colored burgundy cloak. It wouldn't keep the rain off worth a damn, but I was quite fond of it. Not only did it make me look rather dashing, but it was full of clever little pockets, of course. So, I was dressed, fed, and boarded in luxury. But despite this largesse, by noon of the next day I was prowling my rooms like a cat in a crate. I itched to be outside, to have my loot out of pawn, to discover why the mayor needed the service of someone clever, well-spoken, and above all, discreet. Chapter 55. Grace. I peered at the mayor through a gap in the hedge. He was sitting on a stone bench under a shade tree in his gardens, looking every bit the gentleman in his loose sleeves and waistcoat. He wore the house colors of Alvaron, sapphire and ivory. But while his clothes were fine, they weren't ostentatious. He wore a gold signet ring, but no other jewelry. Compared to many others in his court, the mayor was almost plainly dressed. At first, this seemed to imply that Alvaron disdained the fashions of the court. But after a moment, I saw the truth of it. The ivory of his shirt was creamy and flawless, the sapphire of his waistcoat vibrant.
I would have bet my thumbs that they hadn't been worn more than a half dozen times. As a display of wealth, it was subtle and staggering. It was one thing to be able to afford fine clothes, but how much would it cost to maintain a wardrobe that never showed the slightest hint of wear? I thought of what Count Threp had said about Alvaron. Rich as the King of Vint. The mayor himself looked much the same as before. Tall and thin, graying and immaculately groomed. I took in the tired lines of his face, the slight tremble of his hands, his posture. He looks old, I thought to myself, but he's not. The belling tower began to strike the hour. I stepped back from the hedge and strolled around the corner to meet the mayor. Alvaron nodded, his cool eyes looking me over carefully.
Quoth, I was rather hoping you would come.
I gave a semi-formal bow.
I was pleased to receive your invitation, Your Grace.
Alvaron made no gesture for me to seat myself, so I remained standing. I guessed he was testing my manners.
I hope you do not mind our meeting outside. Have you seen the gardens yet?
I haven't had the opportunity, Your Grace. I'd been trapped in my damned rooms until he'd sent for me.
You must allow me to show you around.
He took hold of a polished walking stick that rested against the shade tree.
I've always found that taking some air is good for whatever troubles a body, though others disagree.
He leaned forward as if he would stand, but a shadow of pain crossed his face, and he drew a shallow, painful breath between his teeth. Sick, I realized. Not old. Sick. I was at his side in a twinkling and offered him my arm.
Allow me, Your Grace.
The mayor gave a stiff smile.
If I were younger, I'd make light of your offer.
He sighed.
But pride is the luxury of the strong.
He laid a thin hand on my arm and used my support to gain his feet.
I must settle for being gracious instead.
Graciousness is the luxury of the wise, I said easily. So it can be noted that your wisdom lends you grace. Alvaron gave a wry chuckle and patted my arm.
That makes it a bit easier to bear, I suppose.
Would you like your stick, Your Grace? I asked. Or shall we walk together?
He made the same dry chuckle. Walk together? That's delicately put.
He took the stick in his right hand while his left hand held my arm in a surprisingly strong grip.
Lord and lady, he swore under his breath. I hate to be seen doddering about, but it's less galling to lean on a young man's arm than hobble around on my own. It's a horrible thing to have your body fail you. You never think about it when you're young.
We began to walk, and our conversation lulled as we listened to the sound of water splashing in the fountains and birds singing in the hedges. Occasionally, the mayor would point out a particular piece of statuary and tell which of his ancestors had commissioned it, made it, or, he spoke of these in a quieter, apologetic tone, plundered it from foreign lands in times of war. We walked about the gardens for the better part of an hour. Alvaron's weight on my arm gradually lessened, and soon he was using me more for balance than support. We passed several gentlefolk who bowed or nodded to the mayor. After they were out of earshot, he would mention who they were, how they ranked in court, and a snippet or two of amusing gossip.
"They're wondering who you are,"
he said after one such couple had passed behind a hedge.
By tonight it will be all the talk. Are you an ambassador from Rhaenyra? A young noble looking for a rich fief and a wife to go along? Perhaps you are my long-lost son, a remnant from my wilder youth.
He chuckled to himself and patted my arm. He might have continued, but he stumbled on a protruding flagstone and almost fell. I steadied him quickly and eased him onto a stone bench beside the path.
Damn and bother!
He cursed, obviously embarrassed.
How would that have looked? The mare scrabbling about like a beetle on its back.
He looked around crossly, but we seemed to be alone.
Would you do an old man a favor?
I'm at your disposal, Your Grace.
Alvaron gave me a shrewd look. Are you indeed?
Well, it's a little thing.
Keep secretive about who you are and what your business is. It'll do wonders